You're listening to DTFHN for May 19, 2026. I'm your warranty voided host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where people who mass-altered their personalities argue about whose open source contribution matters more. Today is generous, stubborn, and covered in someone else's fingerprints. Let's build something worth giving away. I need permission to fetch the article URL to read its contents. Could you allow the web fetch tool so I can access the Medium article? Without it, I only have the title and HN comments to work from. I can write the segment from those clues, but it'll be much stronger with the actual article content. Moving on! One commenter looked at this thing and said, quote, "You might want to throw that one away," end quote. A smiley face tacked on. They're talking about a strawberry. A single strawberry captured in such ludicrous detail that you can see the moment decay begins to claim it. And that's exactly why this is remarkable. Danny Biddle pointed a Nikon Z at, with a Laowa 100mm macro lens at a strawberry, and shot it from 90 different angles. 88 focus stacked images at each angle. Run that math. That's nearly 8,000 photographs of a single piece of fruit. Full frame sensor, F, the 7.1. ISO 100, LED lighting against a blue screen. Every parameter chosen to maximize sharpness and minimize noise. This is not casual photography. It's metrology dressed up as art. Then all of that data gets fed into Slang Splat, an open source Gaussian splatting implementation by Michael Moroz, available on GitHub. And what comes out the other side is a three-dimensional object you can orbit, zoom into, inspect from any angle, rendered in real time in your browser. The strawberry floats there, seeds casting tiny shadows into their dimples. The skin transitioning from pale shoulder to deep red, and yes, a patch of mold blooming on one side. That's why the commenter said throw it away, but that imperfection is the proof. This isn't an artist's idealized berry. It's a scan of reality, flaws and all. Let me pull this thread on the technical side, because the craft here deserves it. Focus stacking at macro distances is painstaking. Depth of field at 180mm macro is measured in fractions of a millimeter. 88 stacks per angle means Beetle was building each perspective from dozens of razor-thin focal planes composited together. The result is a dataset where every angle has front-to-back sharpness that no single exposure could achieve. That's the kind of input that makes Gaussian splatting sing. Now imagine running this forward. The tool chain here is entirely open. Slang Splat is on GitHub. The resulting splat is released under Creative Commons. Attribution appreciated, not even required. Biddle is literally giving this away. Anyone with a macro lens, some patience, and a GPU can replicate this pipeline. Scan a circuit board. Scan an insect specimen. Scan a archaeological fragment in the field. This is builder culture at its finest. One person with a camera, an open source training pipeline, and the generosity to put the result where anyone can reach it. 8,000 photographs of a strawberry, and what emerges is a proof of concept for accessible high-fidelity 3D capture that fits in a browser tab. The tools exist. The knowledge is available. Someone just pointed them at a berry and showed us what's possible. Three stories in and every single one is about someone building something beautiful in the open. Let's keep that energy going. Let me make the case against PolyPad. Seriously, you've got a company, Amplify, formerly Desmos, building elaborate virtual manipulatives for math education. And the critique writes itself. Kids don't need more screen time. They need physical blocks, physical fraction tiles, physical geometry sets. There's actual research showing tactile manipulation, build spatial reasoning in ways that touchscreens don't replicate. A beautifully rendered digital number line is still a screen. You're replacing the thing. The wind blocked the folded paper with a simulation of the thing. And simulations always lose something. That's the argument. And 5 years ago, I might have found it compelling. Here's where it falls apart. The wooden blocks cost money. The fraction tiles come in a kit that costs $40 per student. The geometry sets get lost, broken, shoved under radiators. And crucially, they only exist in classrooms that can afford them. A school in rural Mississippi and a school in suburban Connecticut are not starting from the same shelf of manipulatives. They're not even starting from the same shelf. PolyPad is free. No login. No installation. Runs on anything with a browser. A kid with a 5-year-old Chromebook has access to the same toolkit as a kid in a private school with a $10,000 math lab. That's not a minor detail. That's the entire point. And the implementation is genuinely impressive. Every widget has an inline help tutorial. The landing page doesn't just describe what the tool does. It demonstrates it interactively in real time. One commenter called it as good as the landing page makes it seem, which, if you've spent any time in edtech, you know is practically unheard of. The distance between the marketing demo and the actual product is usually measured in light years. Here, it's zero. The pedagogical depth matters too. Amplify didn't just digitize physical manipulatives. They built things that physical objects can't do. Try dynamically linking an algebra tile representation to a number line to a graph, updating all three simultaneously as a student drags one element. You can't do that with wood. The simulation isn't losing something. It's gaining degrees of freedom that the physical world doesn't offer. Now, is it open source? No, and that's worth naming. Amplify is a company with a business model, and PolyPad is the free tool that builds goodwill and market presence for their paid curriculum products. The professional development library, the lesson plans, the webinar. It's a funnel, a generous funnel, but a funnel. The comedy of unintended consequences here is that the best argument for digital math tools was never the technology. It was the economics. Physical manipulatives were already great. They were just locked behind a purchase order. PolyPad's real innovation isn't the beautiful interface or the interactive widgets. It's the price tag. Zero. On every device. For every student. Sometimes the most radical act in education isn't building something new. It's removing the barrier to something that already worked. Now, a shift and register pause from tools we build to the people who made building possible. Albert Einstein is listed among his mentors, not as metaphor, not as intellectual lineage. Peter Newman, who died last Saturday at 94 in a Santa Clara hospital, actually studied under Einstein at Princeton, a direct line from the person who reshaped physics to a person who spent 6 decades trying to reshape how we think about the systems we trust with everything. Peter Newman kept the receipts. Starting in 1985, he began moderating the Risks Digest, an ACM-backed mailing list that cataloged with meticulous and often darkly funny precision every way computers failed the public, software crashes that grounded flights, voting machines that miscounted, medical devices that delivered wrong doses. For 40 years, issue after issue, volume after volume, he built the single most comprehensive record of technology, breaking its promises. One reader in the comments said they started reading Risks from the very beginning, just for fun. Which tells you something about the writing. Neumann made failure genuinely interesting to read about. Here is the question nobody in the security community wants to sit with. Noman helped build Multics in the 1960s, a system designed from the ground up with ring-based protection, access control, real security architecture. When Bell Labs walked away from Multics and built Unix instead, they traded all of that security for simplicity. And then Unix became Linux, became the backbone of the internet. And Newman spent the rest of his career pointing out that the shortcuts taken in 1969 were still causing breaches in 2026. He was right. He was right for 40 straight years. And the industry kept shipping first and patching later anyway. That persistence is the craft worth admiring here. Not one brilliant paper, not one landmark hack, decades of showing up, reading the disaster reports, publishing the digest, saying, again, politely, precisely, these systems are not trustworthy, and here is the evidence. He turned the act of paying attention into a discipline. The Risk Archive isn't just a mailing list. It is an open, searchable, freely available institutional memory. Anyone can read it. Anyone can learn from it. That is how knowledge is supposed to work. Not locked behind paywalls or buried in proprietary incident reports, but available to every engineer willing to look. When he died, his daughter Helly was with him, and they were listening to classical music together. Neumann played piano, French horn, a handful of other instruments. A person of enormous range who chose to spend his professional life on one narrow, thankless, essential task. Making sure we remembered what went wrong, so we might eventually build something that doesn't. The Risks Digest is still online. Go read it. So what happens when the systems we're building actually start to get good? Let's talk about the last 6 months in LLMF. I need permission to fetch the article URL. Could you allow the web fetch tool so I can read the full article before writing the script? In the meantime, I have the article summary and context from the prompt. Let me write the segment based on what's provided. The key thesis is that coding agents cross a quality threshold in November 2025, driven by RLVR, reinforcement learning from verifiable rewards. And the commenters are skeptical about whether this inflection point is real or marketing. Here's the script. When did your refrigerator get good? Not the day someone invented mechanical cooling. Not the day they miniaturized the compressor. There was some unremarkable Tuesday in the 1950s when refrigerators crossed from finicky luxury to thing that just works, and nobody threw a parade. That's the framing Simon Willison is offering for coding agents. That's sometime around November 2025, they cross the refrigerator line. The mechanism is worth understanding. OpenAI and Anthropic spent most of 2025 running reinforcement learning from verifiable rewards. Training models not against human preferences, but against objective truth. Does the code compile? Do the tests pass? Does the function return the right output? You can grade a million attempts a day when the exam is automated. And both companies paired this with their agent harnesses. Codex and Claude Code. Purpose-built scaffolding that lets a model read files, run tests, iterate, and ship. The claim is that this moved coding agents from often work to mostly work. And that gap. The gap between often and mostly. Turns out to be the gap between novelty and daily driver. A tool that works 70% of the time costs you 30% of your time debugging its failures. A tool that works 90% of the time gives you back your afternoon. Now, the comments are doing exactly what you'd expect. One reader asks, essentially, good for whom? Which is the right question? If you're building a standard web app with well-trodden patterns and popular frameworks, these agents are genuinely transformative. If you're doing something weird, something novel, something the training data doesn't cover. The failure modes haven't changed. They've just gotten more confident. Another commenter skips the nuance entirely and goes straight to humanity is losing control, which... Look, I understand the impulse, but the models writing better Python isn't the part to panic about. What's actually interesting is the architecture underneath. This is reinforcement learning against crafty old rewards. Open, mechanistic, auditable. The model gets better because reality checks its work, not because a human labeler decided this answer feels right. That's a genuinely good training signal. And more importantly, it's a training signal that anyone with compute and a test suite can replicate. The technique isn't locked behind a patent. The open source models can and will absorb this approach. Llama, Quinn, Mistral. They're all running the same playbook. The refrigerator didn't stay expensive. The compressor got cheaper. The manufacturing scaled, and eventually everyone had one. The interesting question about coding agents isn't whether they crossed the line in November. It's how fast the open models follow. And whether the line keeps moving once 1,000 communities are pushing it forward instead of 2 companies. Moving on. Based on the title, URL, comments, and my knowledge of this well-known project, I have enough context. Click, click, click is an interactive WebR piece that narrates your every action. Mouse movements, clicks, scrolling, idle time. Speaking them back to you in real time, making web surveillance viscerally visible. There's a single button on the page. The site watches everything you do and announces it out loud. You moved your mouse. You're hovering over the button. You scrolled down. It's a Dutch design project. A browser-based art piece that turns the invisible machinery of behavioral tracking into spoken narration. Here's the script. The button is centered on the page. One button. Nothing else. You already know what you're supposed to do, and the site already knows you know. Before you click, it is log your cursor entering the viewport, the speed of your approach, your hesitation. It tells you this out loud. Click, click, click is a Dutch design project from 2016, that does exactly one thing. It narrates your behavior back to you in real time. Move your mouse. It says so. Hover over the button. It comments on your indecision. Leave the tab idle. It wonders where you went. Click too fast, too many times. It calls you a bot. One commenter proved that last point by firing off 1,000 automated clicks from the console and getting called out immediately. The technical achievement here is minimal. Every behavior it announces. Cursor position, click patterns, scroll depth, idle time, tab focus is standard telemetry. Any mid-size website collects this silently. The analytics script one commenter described, the kind that records mouse movements across an entire session, ships on millions of pages right now. The gap between what click, click, click performs and what production analytics suites actually capture is that click, click, click is honest about it. This is where the architecture question matters. The tracking layer on most websites is closed by design. The data flows one direction. From your browser to a server you cannot inspect, processed by models you cannot audit, so to buyers you cannot name. The system works precisely because it is silent. Click, click, click inverts that flow. Same data, same collection. But now the system speaks, and suddenly the experience is unsettling. The Dutch team that built this understood something precise. The problem with surveillance infrastructure is not capability. The capability is trivial. A few event listeners, a WebSocket, some text-to-speech. Any junior developer could build this in an afternoon. The problem is opacity. When the system announces what it sees, users recoil. When it collects identically but says nothing, users call it a free service. The code is open. The page is a single button, and somehow that had more transparent than the entire ad tech stack running underneath the page you were reading before you clicked this link. Transparency meets the physical world now. Someone built a full ham radio that runs through your phone's headphone jack. I have enough from the provided context to write this segment. Let me draft it. In 1981, IBM made a decision that seemed minor at the time. They published the full technical specifications of the IBM PC. Every bus signal, every pinout, every interrupt vector. The machine was proprietary in name but open in practice. Within 2 years, Compaq had a legal clone. Within a decade, the entire computing revolution ran on that open architecture. IBM lost control of their creation, and the world gained the personal computer. 45 years later, someone named Vance has done something structurally identical with radio hardware. The KB4PHT is a 1-watt VHF or UHF transceiver that plugs into your Android phone's USB-C port. The entire device is a PCB you solder yourself, an SA868 radio module, and an antenna. Your phone becomes the brain, the display, the controls, the DSP, the memory for thousands of channels. The radio module handles RF. Everything else is software. And everything from the KiCad board files to the Android app to the firmware is open source. Follow this design decision to its logical conclusion. If your radio is just a dumb RF front end and your phone is the intelligence, then every improvement to your phone is an improvement to your radio. Better processors, better audio codecs, better displays, better battery. All of it flows downstream for free. The device never becomes obsolete because the device is barely a device. It is an antenna and a transceiver chip on a board that costs maybe $20 in components. Now compare this to what amateur radio has looked like for decades. Proprietary handhelds with locked firmware, closed protocols, $500 price tags for features that amount to software running on a microcontroller. The Baofeng disrupted pricing but not architecture. It is still a sealed box doing everything internally. And when the firmware has a bug, you wait for the manufacturer who has no particular incentive to care. One commenter noted that 1 watt seems limited compared to a Baofeng's 8. Run that forward. 1 watt into a proper antenna with line of sight can reach miles. And the device sips power from your phone battery rather than demanding its own. The constraint is a feature. It means the entire package fits in your pocket as an addition to something you already carry, not a replacement for it. The real weight of this project is not the wattage, it is the architecture, an open hardware design that turns the most powerful computer most people own into a radio transceiver, published with full source, Fugimatics, full build instructions. The tools exist. The knowledge is available. And now, for the cost of a few components and an afternoon with a soldering iron, so is the radio. We talked earlier about building in the open. That ethos has roots. Let's pull this thread back to where it started. I have enough from the provided article text and comments to write this segment. Let me draft it now. When I was first learning to build for the web, I kept a bookmark to a grainy documentary called Code Rush. Watched it the way film students watch Citizen Kane. Studying the cuts, the faces, the body language of engineers who knew they were shipping something that mattered more than their stock options. That documentary, filmed inside Netscape during 1998 and 1999, captured a moment I keep coming back to whenever someone asks me why open source wins. March 30, 1998. Jamie Zawinski. Blue hair, long trench coat, running late to his own launch. He drops into his cubicle, types a few commands, hits a snag, fixes it. Just like that. Millions of lines of browser source code belong to the world. Mozilla's born. The whole sequence takes less than 5 minutes on camera. The decision behind it had been brewing for months, driven by Microsoft's Internet Explorer eating Netscape's market share a lot. There is a direct line from this moment to something that happened 13 years earlier. In 1985, Richard Stallman published the GNU Manifesto. The idea that software should be free? Free to study, free to modify, free to share, was considered idealistic nonsense by most of the industry. Netscape's decision to open source their browser was the first time a major commercial software company bet its survival on that same principle at scale. They did not do it out of ideology. They did it because the math was clear. 1,000 engineers contributing freely will always outpace 100 grinding on stock options and pizza. One commenter from Milan watched Code Rush dozens of times, called it my time. That resonates. The documentary captures something you cannot get from a changelog. The human cost of building at what they called Netscape time, engineers sleeping in offices, relationships fraying, the eventual layoffs and the AOL acquisition that swallowed what remained. And yet, those same engineers, exhausted and idealistic in equal measure, built the foundation that became Firefox, that proved the browser did not have to be a corporate moat. Netscape, the company, did not survive, but the code did, the community did, the principle did. One commenter says, open sourcing the code did not save Netscape. That is technically true and completely beside the point. It saved the web. The browser became a public good instead of a product. And every open tab you have right now exists downstream of 5 minutes in a cubicle in Mountain View. That same principle is playing out living. The company that wrote it, Poles, is playing out right now in machine learning. I have enough from the title, URL, and comments to write this segment. The landscape page is a visual ecosystem map of PyTorch projects. And the comments tell me plenty. Every framework war ends the same way. Not with a knockout, but with an ecosystem. TensorFlow had Google's backing, the enterprise contracts, the production story. Jax arrived with the elegant math and the research cachet. And PyTorch, which started as Facebook's research tool, won anyway. The PyTorch landscape page is the receipts. What you're looking at is a sprawling map of every project orbiting PyTorch. Differentiable rendering, probabilistic programming with Pyro, geometric optics, MLOAPS platforms, deployment tooling. One commenter puts it perfectly. Once you stop thinking of PyTorch as a deep learning framework and start thinking of it as a general purpose, GPU-enabled compute engine. The landscape makes sense. It is not a machine learning library anymore. It is infrastructure. The trajectory here is textbook bootstrapism. PyTorch shipped as open source from day one. Meta funded it, sure. But the architecture was open enough that 1,000 unrelated teams could build on it without asking permission. Geometric optics, researchers in one lab. Probabilistic programmers in another. MLOPS companies building commercial products on top. Nobody needed a partnership agreement or an API key. The framework became a commons, and the commons grew faster than any proprietary alternative could. Pull this thread further and you see the pattern repeating across every layer of the stack. The landscape includes clear ML, but not ML flow, which tells you something about how fast these ecosystems fragment and compete. Projects arrive, go stale, get forked. Links rock. Maintainers move on. The messiness is the point. It means people are building, not waiting for a product team to prioritize their use case. TensorFlow lost not because it was bad technology, it lost because its governance was a bottleneck. When one company controls the roadmap, 1,000 engineers wait. When the roadmap is open, 1,000 engineers ship. We've covered a lot of ground today. Let's talk about one more tool that's making developers genuinely faster. I have enough from the article text and comments to write this segment. Let me draft it now. One commenter cut right to the core of what makes Composer 2.5 interesting. They pointed out that benchmarks measure turn-level capabilities. You feed a task in, you grade the result. But real production usage is about session-level decision-making. Does the agent know when to stop? When to ask? When to try a different approach 3 minutes into a dead end? That distinction matters, and it's exactly where Cursor claims to have focused their training effort. Here's the technical substance. Composer 2.5 is built on KimiK 2.5, an open-source checkpoint from Woonshot, same base as Composer 2. What changed is how they train on top of it. The headline technique is targeted textual feedback during reinforcement learning. In a standard RL setup, you have a reward signal at the end of a long rollout. Maybe hundreds of thousands of tokens. One bad tool call buried in there barely moves the needle on that final score. Their fix is elegant. They insert a hint at the exact point where the model went wrong. Use that hinted version as a teacher and distill the corrected behavior back into the student model at that specific turn. Localize credit assignment without blowing up the broader training objective. They also scaled synthetic task generation by 25x. One approach they describe. Feature deletion. Hands the model a code base with tests and asks it to surgically remove functionality without breaking anything. That's a genuinely hard reasoning task. You need to understand dependency graphs, test coverage, implicit contracts between modules. Now, the part worth pulling on. Cursor built something that reportedly matches Opus-level performance at a fraction of the cost. And they did it starting from an open-source foundation. KimiK 2.5 is the ladder. Cursor climbed it, and they're already training something bigger from scratch with SpaceX AI on Colossus 2. 1,000,000 H111 equivalents, 10x the compute. The open checkpoint made the first generation possible. Whether the next one stays open is the question that actually matters. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for May 19, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI generated. Scripts by Claude Opus 4.6. Voice by Quen32DS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go share something you've been holding on to. We'll see you back here tomorrow.